Hello and welcome to another episode of the Shock Doctors Podcast. I'm Jim Smith. And we are the Shock Doctors. In this episode, we're going to be discussing bones and all, and it's been a bit of a journey getting this one in the can. Yeah, it's been approximately a week for each of us since we actually saw the film, which is, as I imagine most of our regular listeners know, or maybe not, contrary to our regular practice of essentially watching the film and then recording as quickly as possible. Now, that's been fudged a little bit more than it was historically, I think, since we're no longer grouped together and we've each got our own schedules. But back when we were recording these in person, typically we would go to the theater or throw the movie on at my place, and then basically the second the credits finished, we'd have a quick bathroom break at most, and then we'd plow immediately into it. So just bang it out as quickly as possible. Yes. Soldiering ahead. Yes. Yes, this is hopefully, needless to say, an upgrade for her. So, good for her. Hopefully she's not under contract for another 3 escape room movies or some shit. Hopefully she can keep moving onward and upward. Yes, quite literally on the hook. Yeah, not to mention the fact that, like the Saw movies, it's basically an infinitely replicable template. You just, in Saw, you just make up the new murder traps. And in a sense, that's exactly what you do with Escape Room. Obviously, the murder traps are just rooms as opposed to, I don't know, a jaw bear trap device, whatever. Yeah. Yes. apparently Tobin Bell is coming back for the next movie. I don't even understand. From the book of Saw. Anyway. Yeah, we're getting way off here. Right. Right. Marin. Yeah, well, first they skip town, and then he abandons her and leaves behind a tape-recorded message explaining why he left and filling her in on some of her cannibal history. And the first, or I guess the next half hour or so of the movie is kind of sprinkled with periodic dispatches from this recording that her father made, and it's a device that I really enjoyed and was a little disappointed it didn't kind of stick with that. I mean, if it had gone like a metronome all the way through the movie, that probably would have felt a little played out, but I think I could have used a little bit more dispatches from Dad over the tape recorder. Yeah. I think he might. But he's got this ratty ponytail and this sort of rawhide vest that he wears. It's just, yeah, he is deeply, deeply strange. I can't think of the performance I'm thinking of, but at least the voice he's doing and some of the mannerisms remind me of another one of his performances, and I can't think of what it is, but it's just this weird sort of twangy, I don't know, bumpkin voice. Right. No. Goddamn weirdo. Yeah, I think invoking Twin Peaks is apt. I think there's definitely some of that flavor in there. I don't know who specifically in Twin Peaks necessarily, but just. That's like you don't want to mess around with Sully. Sully's a weird dude. Right. Yeah. Sure. It's a compulsion, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, and one grisly detail about Sully that should not go unacknowledged, although if it didn't crop up now, I'm sure it would later. He keeps a hair rope, for lack of a better term. It's like 8 feet of people's hair tied together, and supposedly each link in the chain, so to speak, is a person he has eaten. He keeps it all wrapped in a loop, which is then tucked inside some kind of tablecloth or handkerchief or something, and it goes in his satchel. Upgrade to a tablecloth. That's exactly right. Yeah, it just doesn't seem to register with him what he's doing, even though gives this speech about how he has rules and whenever possible, he likes to get his eating done in situations like this where he hasn't killed this woman. She has, like, I've fallen and I can't get up sort of a situation where she was dying. And he found her like that, and he just kind of waits for the person to die, and then he eats as soon as they're dead. Right, but on the flip side, he says shit like, I better get up before I get stuck to this chair. And, okay, that's what we're talking about right now, not the fact that you just ate somebody and you're covered head to toe in blood. In your tidy whiteies. Of course, I mean, Marin at this point has eaten too. They eat the woman together. So it's not as though she's... Now, there are particular circumstances where eating gets done where she has qualms about it. But the concept itself, there's not a lot of that stuff. I do remember this bit in part because I scanned the Wikipedia synopsis, but also I remember how this went down. So Marin at one point, basically when Sully is, I don't know, like showering or just off doing something in the woman's house, Marin flees to the bus stop and gets on the bus after Sully has made an overture to like, well, why don't you travel the road with me for a while? I'm getting a little too Foghorn Leghorn already, but I'm no big city lawyer. There's a little bit of that in there, but it's a lot weirder. It's a lot weirder. But yeah, she apparently has no interest in cruising the highways and byways with Sully, which is probably for the best. In fact, almost certainly. So she gets on the bus, takes it to Columbus, I think. She was headed for Columbus, or maybe she's already in Columbus. Anyway, she takes it to the next way station, maybe Indiana, and she goes into like a dollar store, convenience store or something for supplies, and she's kind of getting a five-finger discount, surreptitiously stuffing stuff in her bag. And Lee is one customer in the aisle that she's browsing in, and this lout is another one, and he like brushes by some woman and her child who are apparently in a hurry, and then he says something like, you gonna watch where you're going, and he starts berating this poor woman. And then Lee kind of leaps into the fray and starts smack talking with him and basically baits him into going outside, presumably this guy thinks for a fist fight, but gets him in like an abandoned building next door and eats him. Marin, who has learned from Sully how to smell other eaters, catch them by scent, has figured out when they're both in the store together that Lee is an eater. And so she goes outside and she sees him coming out of the other building covered in blood. And he invites her to go along with him on his travels. Correct. But she, it's not a surprise to her when he comes out with blood all over his face. It's not like, oh, you're an eater too? It's like, no, this is exactly what I expected to find when I looked in this direction. Yeah, and it would also have taken like 4.5 hours, probably. So they steal the dead guy's truck and they go and pilfer his house. It's here that we find out that Lee is really into Kiss, among other things. They find some Kiss record and put it on because, you don't know Love Gun or whatever the fuck. No, Lick It Up is the name of the record. And it makes a point to say, this is the first one where they didn't have the makeup on. This is all like nothing is registering to Marin, of course. But he puts the record on and the title track comes on and he's just fucking strutting around the room, jamming out. He makes some crack about, yeah, this guy probably spent the last 30 years sitting in here getting high and tearing ass or something like that. But yeah, they decide to head on off to Kentucky, at least at first. Marin still has this plan to go find her mother. That's what she was on the road for. But they're going to stop in Kentucky, where Lee is from, so he can drop in on his little sister. And that interaction is rather fraught. We get the sense that he's kind of on the run, maybe a little bit, because he seems to like not want to be spotted by anyone, and they're staying in like his aunt's house or something. His aunt's dead, and lock all the doors, don't turn on the lights, shit like that. And then he shows up back at the house with his sister. Sister is played by Anna Cobb, who's the lead from We're All Going to the World's Fair. So that was kind of neat to see her in something else. This is the second thing I've ever seen her in. Authorized movies or podcast movies. Yeah, she gets in a bit of a shouting match with him, and Marin's just kind of befuddled by all of this. And in short order, they hit the road again. Who looks like a hillbilly golem? I mean, Stuhlbarg is absolutely fucking horrifying in this scene. No. Yeah. Oh God, that's absolutely horrifying. It's way more terrifying than the T-Rex ever was, and that's no disrespect to Steven Spielberg. It's just headlight and pitch black, and the way the shot's framed, he basically charges all the way up to the camera, and you almost get that sensation with like a 3D movie, like Jesus Christ, he's gonna come out of the screen and eat my face. This is. Before they cut that part out, bastards. So there's a couple of tidbits in this vignette. So it's Michael Stuhlbarg and then this other guy who's with him, who I wouldn't have known it to look at him, but it's David Gordon Green playing the other guy. And apparently the other guy is not an eater in the traditional sense. He doesn't have the craving. He's like some weird groupie. He's just like, yeah, I'll try some human flesh. That sounds radical, you know. Right. 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 And both of them are put off by this. I don't remember who takes more umbrage. I think it's Marin, but it could have been Lee. Either way, both of them are very freaked out by this guy. And Stuhlbarg also goes into this disquisition about, it's the source of the title, talks about what it's like to eat someone, bones and all. Literally, you know, down to their bones, obviously, but like, you know, down to their toenails, every scrap of a person. And he frames it as like, it's the new frontier. It's the last threshold. The way he frames it is, there's before bones and all, and after. Yeah, it's just, Marin's like, that's not even possible. How could you eat that? Which is a fair point. How can you eat even like 130 pounds of person? I mean, I guess maybe he's like refrigerating them. I don't, before they go bad, you know, it's. Oh. Yeah. Yeah, the nurse hands Marin a letter that her mother wrote her, presumably pre-auto cannibalism. Unless she did it with her mouth, you know, put the pen between her teeth. Her mother in the letter sort of explains why she felt she had to leave and what she hoped could become of Marin if she wasn't around. I hoped you could get better. I hope you wouldn't have what I have, or at least as much of what I have. I also, you know, I didn't want to end up eating you, etc., etc. But if you're here, it probably means you'd be better off dead. And as Marin is finishing reading this, her mother has timed it such that she intends to make that a self-fulfilling prophecy. She pounces almost immediately, even though she's apparently heavily medicated and more or less nonverbal. She... And handless, obviously, also. And she might have been, like, one-legged, or, like, one leg was, you know, missing below the knee because she ate one calf, too. Like, but she lunges at her to try and kill her, and the nurse intervenes, and Marin gets away. Yeah. Yeah. I think it might have been before they get to this stretch, but at one point they go to a state fair carnival sort of thing, and Lee basically cruises a carny. Yeah, because they go back to the guy's car and do the classic flipping down the visor, and he's got the picture of his family there, you know, right, wife and two kids, and they drive the car back to his place. It's not super cl Oh, no, they don't do that until they've driven there, 'cause they're gonna pull the same trick they did with the first guy, gonna rip off his house for whatever they can find in there to keep funding their expedition. And they see people walking around inside the house through the window, and that's when they find out, oh, he had a wife and two kids. You know, fuck. So this, coupled with just everything else that's gone on, kind of drives Marin to decide she's got to go her own way again. Even though she and Lee have fallen for each other in a pretty big way, she still decides, this is too much. And so she splits while Lee's sleeping in the car at the gas station shortly after they leave the hospital. And it doesn't take long for her to run into Sully, who has apparently been following them basically since she left Columbus. Wherever it goes. Well, basically, he says something about her and, like, you could have been my daughter's age if I had one. And she latches onto that a little too much. And it seems like he's put out by her viewing him in that way because he had some sort of romantic delusions. Right. So when she essentially rebuffs his advances and once again declines to join him, this time he's literally driving around in a panel van. Yeah, he just shouts at her, you know, you stupid, etc. Drives off in a huff. Right. I call this one macaroni. Jimmy Stewart. Oh, shit. Yeah, well, his dad, in addition to being just an abusive alcoholic who beat Lee and his sister, his dad was also an eater. And so they got into another fight. The sister leaves to get the cops, basically. And in the course of the ensuing scuffle, Lee's father bites him, tries to start eating him, and Lee proceeds to get the upper hand, kills his dad, and eats him instead. And then hides his dad's corpse in his trunk and drives the car off to some deserted barn or other. So the cops initially thought that Lee was the prime suspect because they found him with blood all over him. Then they found out that it's actually Lee's blood, and so they kind of let him off the hook, but still the sort of stink of that whole affair is why he has to tiptoe around his hometown. Because people still, they don't know the cannibalism bit, but they think he's a father murderer, even if the cops could never prove it. gob of spittle just sort of droops from his mouth, and he just fucking leaves it there, man. He's too busy going for it. Yeah, it's Lee's sister. I can't remember exactly when they find this. I don't know that he actually presents it to them or if they find it afterwards. But either way, they eventually do figure out that he has eaten Lee's sister. Now, the way this goes down, Marin is alone when he pounces. And, of course, Sully's like, where's your little boyfriend? All that stuff. That would have been preposterous, but also incredible. I'll show you the life of the mind. So yeah, Lee shortly thereafter, fortunately, gets home, and again, fortunately, does not make much noise coming in. So he sees what's going on. Marin can see him and is waiting for him to basically come to the rescue. And he gets behind Sully, puts a plastic bag over his head and starts trying to smother him. And kind of together, they're grappling with Sully. Sully's got this big knife. That's what he's been threatening Marin with. And looks like they're going to get it away from him. And then it looks like it might have gotten plunged somewhere not good other than him. And sure enough, after they've managed to kill him and drag him into the bathtub, presumably for disposal, either with their gullets or however else, Lee kind of slumps down against the door jamb, and we see that he got one of these 6-inch deep knife gouges in his chest. So he's not long for this world, and he basically tells Marin, he insists, like, I want you to eat me, bones and all. And yeah, that's the whole movie, pretty much.
Dad!
You didn't. When the cops get here, you have to be good and gone.
I can't help you anymore.
I know it's not your fault. You were born this way.
You ate them. I believed you had to. I don't know why.
I smelt you. I didn't know I could do that.
I thought I was the only one. I don't want to hurt anybody.
Famous last words.
Hello, listeners. It's Jim, here as always during the break to tell you some stuff you probably already know. Please follow us on Twitter at Shock Doctors Pod, on Facebook at facebook.com/shockdoctorspod, or check us out on Apple Podcasts. The podcast is also available on Spotify, Stitcher, and TuneIn. If you've got an idea for a movie you'd like us to check out, feel free to send us a DM on social media or email us at shockdoctorspod@gmail.com. And now, back to the show.
I came looking for you. I smelled you.
You can smell me half a mile away. Can you do that?
Not that far. I got rules. Never, never, ever ate an eater.
I thought you might be hungry.
Friends?
No.
Who lives here? Is there someone dead up there? I'm not gonna be like that.
We don't have many options. Either you eat, you off yourself, or you lock yourself up in there.
And we're back. So, I like this movie a lot. I don't like it as much as Suspiria, but that'd be kind of tough to do because I think that was my second favorite movie of 2018, so that's a pretty high bar. But yeah, it's grody and awesome and weirdly touching. The ending is pretty hardcore, too, because we didn't drop this detail in the synopsis, but the way they kind of finish off Sully is they pull his heart out. The only thing I would have preferred that this scene do that it didn't do was clearly, again, they're pulling his heart out, and this movie has not been bashful up to this point about gore, but Luca gets ever so slightly precious about it here because we don't see the heart come out. We see Marin like reach into the chest a little bit, but I was waiting for the shot, like a wide of just the whole bathroom, maybe even framed in the door frame or something, where Marin's holding his heart outside of his chest or something like that. Right. Right. Well, yeah, and not to mention that in as much as this movie has a big bad, this is the guy, and they're finishing him off. Make that as sensational as possible, I think. Uh-huh. Just let it rot or whatever. And again, even if they didn't eat it, just seeing them holding the heart outside of the chest, I could have used some of that. Yeah. Uh-huh. Right. Right. Well, and this is another thing that I think could have been aided by a little more persistence on the dad tape recorder device. He's normal and he is. Right, and. Right, insofar as anybody serves as the movie's conscience, it's him. Obviously, his hands are not even remotely clean because he has repeatedly cleaned up after his daughter, but he still has remorse, and like you say, that's why he bailed. There is, I think, one snippet from him that is not in that just half hour window relatively early on. It comes up later. I don't remember exactly where it's placed now, but if you did have a couple more of those in the back half of this movie to just again remind you, hey, normal people aren't just cattle. If they have opinions about these sorts of things, if given the opportunity, I think you're right. That could have been to the movie's benefit, just having that reality check. Yes. Right. Yeah. No. Well, that's not unique to the climax either. He does that basically for the whole movie. So it's worse, yeah. No, but I think like Marin calls him to account on it. Like, why do you call yourself Sully like you're talking about somebody else? And I think at first he kind of deflects, but this might have even been part of the confrontation when he's in his panel van. She questions his behavior and he doesn't take too kindly to it. But the actor who plays Marin's dad is Andre Holland, who, among other things, he's in the third act of Moonlight. He's the guy that Chiron meets and... Yeah. And he is also the lead in the first season of the Hulu Castle Rock show. Henry Deaver, I think, is the character's name. He's the writer who is like back in Castle Rock and investigating all this weird stuff. And you know, again, you're absolutely right. The guy's got a great voice, and it's sort of perfectly suited for this sort of material where, like, in Castle Rock, he's reading through these old stories, and in Bones and All, he's telling an old story of his own for his daughter's benefit, or at least as sort of an absolution for himself, bearing his soul. But yeah, no, that's... Again, that's why another reason I could have used more of that, not just because structurally it was interesting, but it's a good performance with what, you know, little screen or at least audio track time he gets. This is kind of an interesting random tidbit. I'm looking at IMDb trivia for Andre Holland, and the last little note here is that in 2018 he played Othello in a production of Othello at the Globe Theater in London, and Mark Rylance played Iago. That would have been pretty wild. Right. Those are Robitel joints, aren't they? Okay. I'm just trying to remember which of the three or four horsemen of the apocalypse we have to blame for that one. Yeah. Right. Well, yeah, they just get to make millions of dollars making schlock, and we get to make negative money because we, you know, hosting fees and whatnot to complain about their schlock. So there is no justice. Your Honor, is this justice? Speaking of Timothy Chalamet, something that was kind of interesting, I happened to read a review, or I think more accurately, a Metacritic blurb of a review that compares his performance to River Phoenix in My Own Private Idaho. And this is a movie, My Own Private Idaho, that I actually had never seen until quite recently, so it's relatively fresh for me. And as such, I feel like I could speak to that comparison a little bit more directly than I might otherwise. I don't think it's a comparison that's entirely out of left field. At the same time, if anything, I think this performance has more in common with Keanu in that movie than River Phoenix, because River Phoenix is sort of fumbling and unsure of himself most, not all the time, but most of that movie, he just seems kind of unsettled and adrift, whereas Keanu's all cocksure and cracking wise all the time. And I think, right. Is it the fourth or the fifth that one's based on? It doesn't matter. He's the Henry, yeah, whichever English King Henry it is. It is not, unfortunately. It's some other guy I'm not familiar with. Okay. Sure. But anyway, it's a good performance overall, I think. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes. One other thing I feel like I noticed, and it's difficult to pin down exactly, but the one camera work detail that I felt like I picked up on a few different times in the movie was it had some of those same 70s style zooms that I think we talked about at some length for X. I don't know if you caught any of those, but it just felt like a couple different times I'm like, oh yeah, this is, in terms of the film grammar, grounding me as a period piece in the way that doesn't often happen. So that's a nice touch. Obviously, you know, it's set in the 80s, but that's close. Yeah. Right. Oh, the J.J. Abrams, like robot zoom. Yeah. Gross. Yeah, I haven't seen it yet, so I can't speak to that. Right. We're not going to be able to swing recommendations this time. Well, I can spit them out real quick. So you already invoked one of them. Near Dark is a movie that I was reminded of. In that case, it's not a period piece, obviously. It's just a film made in the 80s. But that's sort of like, in that case, vampires. In this case, cannibals. Similar thing. On the road in the 80s. Stylistically, Near Dark's a lot more over the top, I think, than this movie is. But nonetheless, there's some parallels there. Only Lovers Left Alive, another vampire movie. I got, I don't know, vibes. I can't really pin down. And then just in terms of young lovers on the run through the heartland, I got a little bit of Badlands Zhuzh from the movie. So those were all on my radar. Yeah, I think 76 maybe. Yeah, Martin's good stuff, so I endorse that recommendation. But for now, Lee has been eaten, bones and all, and so I think we're all done here. But until... But Sully has not. Justice for Sully. Until next time, I'm Jim Smith. And we are the Shock Doctors. We'll see you later.
As always, we have some acknowledgments. Our music was composed by Will Connor. Audio for the bumpers was taken from Bones and All theatrical trailer, uploaded by MGM. All rights reserved. Our next episode will be up on Sunday, January 1st, and we will be discussing the latest Benson and Moorhead joint, Something in the Dirt. See you then.